Hey everybody, welcome to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, and the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook. And I am so excited to have my editor, Nikki McDonald, from both books, the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, here with me to talk a little bit about the book and the history of it and how publishing works, and then maybe some other stuff after that. We're going to flip the script, and she's going to interview me for a little bit somewhere in here. So welcome, Nikki, and how are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be on the podcast finally. After all of these years, I get to be a guest.
Yes. Well, I'm excited to have you on because I think there's some stories maybe that even I haven't heard that would be fun to get out and sort of let people hear them. So to start it off, why don't you give us some context about what you do and what you did as part of the books that we produced together?
Well, I have been editing books for Peach Pit for almost 10 years. I worked for Peach Pit for longer than that, but in various roles. I've done a little bit of everything. But then I started acquiring books, 8 years ago. And one of my first authors was Mr. Von Glitschka, who is a talented and amazing illustrator, snarky, funny guy. And we became really good friends. And at some point, we had such a good relationship, he would start recommending authors to me and trying to help me out because I'd call him every so often and cry and say, I need some acquisitions. I'm behind. I need some new books and new people. And he's kind of my scout, and he'd keep an eye out for me. And then one day he sent me a note and introduced me to you. And he's like, I have this great guy. He does this visual note taking technique. He calls it sketchnoting, and he's got a sketchnote army. And he hooked us up. And gosh, when was this? 2011.
11, I think. And so the weird side story to that, too, is that we actually had – I was in Portland for another conference, and we had dinner at a Thai restaurant. And on his way home from the Thai restaurant to his house with his wife driving, he actually emailed you and me. So that it was like moments after they dropped us off at our hotel that he was emailing you, and then from there it just sort of happened.
He's an amazing networker. He's, he comes up with an idea and it's, he jumps right on it. So funny. I love Von. Von, if you're listening, hi.
Yeah,
how you doing?
We'll have to mention him in the when we tweet this out so he can listen.
Everyone should go check out Von's site.
Yes.
Because he does the coolest stuff. And he has a couple of books out too. I published them, Vector Basic Training and Take and Make Art. You can buy and get some. This is not a sales show. I'm not selling his books, but they're just really great. He's a great guy. So
definitely. We'll put him in the show notes, everybody, so you can check him out.
So anyway, he introduced me to you and you pitched your book. And I remember when you first pitched it, we were trying to decide how to do it, right? Like, should it be just a straight up book with lots of words? Should it be mostly pictures? And I remember talking about it in our editorial meeting, and I was pitching you and the idea, and our chief of marketing at the time, his name was Scott Collin. He no longer works for Peach, but now he works for Rocky Nook, and he's the publisher of the photography book company. He was like, this book should be, it's so visual. You should do it. You should do it as one, make it all illustrated. Make it like a, almost like a graphic novel. And we had not really ever done anything like that before. And I was kind of surprised he suggested it because it was a little risky. I mean, at the time we were kind of cutting back on print. We were moving into digital and selling more ebooks, and your book does not necessarily lend itself easily to the ebook format. So that would be a challenge. And in fact, when I set it up, I didn't even think we would sell an ebook version of it because it would just be too hard to do it and do it well. So, I mean, immediately there go all the digital sales, which were growing and when print was not at the time. So that was kind of risky. And also it kind of cuts off international sales because we thought it would probably be pretty unlikely actually that we would be able to sell it internationally because it'd be so difficult to translate. But it just really called for that kind of format. And so I have marketing support early on to do it, and you were on board, and it was a risk for us, but it turned out to be a really good one. The book turned out better than anybody, I think, expected.
Yeah, especially, I mean, I'd never done a book before other than illustrating four books. I'd done large publishing projects as a designer, but really hadn't done anything of that magnitude before. So I was confident I could do it, but it's just something I didn't. It's funny because you kept saying, this is really good, like after the book came out, and like, well, I have no frame of reference because I've never done a book before. Like, if you say so.
Well, you know, you are good too, because a lot of people come to me and they think almost everyone who came to me expected their book to be a New York Times bestseller. You know, like it's going to sell a million copies, it's going to sell, 50,000 copies, 100,000 copies. And that is so unrealistic. It's not, it's not how it works. So your expectations were not, you know, you didn't have any, which was great. Yeah. It was great. So you weren't disappointed. In fact, we were all pleasantly surprised because the book sold extremely well.
Yeah, I agree.
It sold so well that Amazon jumped in and helped us make a special enhanced
edition.
Yeah, the Kindle edition, which has challenges. It didn't work out quite like we wanted it to. We had issues there getting it to look right, but that was kind of Amazon driven. And the fact that they wanted to do it at all was a testament to the success of the book. And eventually we got that worked out. And then all the international editions were surprising. Like tell me, Mike, many languages?
So I guess I can count them on my fingers, but it started with the Germans. They reached out first and wanted to do the handbook in German. And so that deal got done. And then shortly after that, the Russians came and reached out and said, hey, we want to do this in Russian. And the Russians were kind of crazy. It was awesome because they like translated every last stroke of words from English characters into Cyrillic letters. Like, I don't know, there's some factory or some room where all these people were just like converting. And the crazy thing in the Russian one is the style is exactly right for each artist. Like, it doesn't look like somebody did that. And then I think the next one were the Czechs and the Chinese. They both sort of happened around the same time. And I think the Czech version came out just a little bit before the Chinese version did. So, and then after the workbook, then the Germans, of course, came first and then Russians. And we're still not there with Chinese or Czech on those versions. But those are possible. And right now we're in the middle of a French version. So that should be coming out, I think, in the fall sometime.
I think that's really exciting. I mean, we never expected it to, I don't know, for anyone to do it. It's so difficult because you can't, the way the book is created, you can't just swap out the text for translated text. I mean, it's a huge investment on the publisher's part who are licensing the book and yours too. I mean, you have to be willing to do that work. So,
right.
You know, so the book was just I love how it took off. You know, I love how it really captured people's, imagination, and it got them excited. People were excited to get the book and to do it and to like, I remember being at a sales conference and the book just came out. I was at a Pearson sales conference and I was sitting next to one of our sales people, and we're listening to some boring, super boring lecture, and I was trying to stay awake by taking sketch notes. I was trying to do it myself, and I'm not very good. I am in no way an artist. I am ideas, definitely not art. So my drawings weren't great, but it was really fun to do. And people started leaning over and watching me look at the table.
Wow.
They made me share my notes so they could all see them. And I was telling them about the book, and then I sent copies to some of the salespeople. And like a few weeks later, one of the women sent me an email thanking me. And she was so excited. And she sent me pictures of her sketch notes. And she said she bought colored pens. And she
wow.
was like, yeah, so it was firsthand. It was really fun to see how people react to that.
Yeah, yeah, the same for me too. Like, and I think, when we made it, we didn't know like who the audience was, kind of. Like, I had the sense that UX people were into it because we saw that happening in other you know, some design people were into it. And I think UX user experience people, because we, you know, I'm a user experience designer by day. We deal with lots of structure and organization and those kind of things. And we are somewhat visual. So the alignment seemed like it worked out really well. But other than that, we sort of didn't know, like, would teachers love or hate me? And it turned out that teachers are still going crazy for it. I keep getting these, hey, I just found this great book called The Sketchnote Handbook, and I'm teaching my kids how to use it. And, you know, that's 4 years later that the book has been out, and they're just discovering it and now applying it. We have a former guest who is on the show and a friend, Michael Clayton, who is a professor at University of the Incarnate Word down in San Antonio, and he's actually building a curriculum around sketchnoting to teach it at the university. So, I mean, it's kind of popping up all over the place, and it's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things I was excited about, too, when you started, when the you know, it went out and you started getting these stories back from the people who bought the book. That's what I don't get a lot of that as an editor. I only hear secondhand what readers think of the book. I have to either read the Amazon reviews or ask the authors. But you, as an author, you get lots of feedback. I mean, my authors generally always did get a lot of feedback from readers. And sometimes it was, I mean, that's really the most gratifying part, to hear like how your work has affected other people's lives, like in some ways enormously. And I loved hearing the stories you got from like some of the people who got the book and were using it and how it kind of transformed the way they did things. And maybe I'm going to flip the interview right now. I'm like, maybe some of the stories from, you know, share some of the cool ones for the people, you know, who had, picked it up. And
well, let me think about this. I don't remember all of them in vivid detail, but I know that when they would come in, I was pretty religious about forwarding them to you, because I felt like, well, you know, I was really grateful that you took a chance and sort of, we did this really, really different thing of a book, right? It was unusual from a production perspective. It was, the content was really different. Like, we did things like two color when we could do four color. We rounded the corners. The paper was different. The coating on the cover actually was kind of accidental, right? Like, we were going to do a linen, and it was, you said, dude, this is weird, we got to do something else, and you picked something else. And now it's like that cover texture, whatever that stuff is super popular, and we see, I'm seeing it pop on up on other books too.
And so, well, because everyone, when that book, that was, because remember, we were trying to make it feel like a moleskin. We were trying to make it feel like a notebook, to kind of replicate the look and feel. And so we were trying out various different finishes, and it's a matte laminate, no scuff finish, for those who really want to know. But I remember the first reviews came back, everyone talked about how the book felt. You know, they just couldn't stop touching it. Everyone wanted to touch it. And it did. It felt like all velvety. It was nice to hold in your hands. Like, the look and feel of it, the book, was, I think, as much a part of the success as, you know, the inside of it. So that's a part of the job that people don't think about sometimes. You think about editing. When we put together a book, when we think about a book, we think about all of it, right? We think about not just the words and the pictures and the content, but we think about how it's going to feel in your hand. You know, how big does it need to be? Like, what the trim size is going to be? How many pages is going to be? Would it be, if it's, you know, sometimes if you have a small book and, you know, a lot of page, if you don't have enough pages, it feels too thin and doesn't feel like it's worth the money. So like, a lot goes into like the thinking about the look and feel of every part of the book. And I think for this book, every part worked, you know, like it just came together. But
yeah, I think it was sort of a combination of, so I'd been in printing production for a long time and a designer and done pretty much anything you can do. So that helped, I think, because I could imagine what it would look like when you would tell me like what your ideas were, if I had an idea, and you'd been doing it a long time. So we both sort of had this language where we could talk about, yeah, it could be like this and that, and we could understand what we were talking about. So I think part of it was our, you know, the experience that we had together, coming together. But I think a little bit of it was probably luck too. We're lucky that everything worked out and the budgets worked out and the timing, and there was sort of a demand. Like, I still feel like it's really easy for me to think, I did such a fantastic job. And then I realized, like, okay, it was probably a lot of good hard work and we did a lot of things right. But there's a lot of books that were done really well and production quality was good and they flop, right? There's part of this whole mix that you just have to put up to, once you release it, it's not yours anymore, right? and we just sort of timed out right, that the demand aligned really well with producing the book, and it worked out really well for people's what they wanted, I think.
Well, I think a little bit too is because it's kind of timeless. People like to draw. I mean, look at the success of coloring books right now, which is kind of ridiculous. You know, how many, all the grown up coloring books, it's because people will always like to doodle and draw. It makes them feel creative. And to make it, you know, a book that made it simple to do, that gave simple tips to take to making pictures, I think that's just universally appealing, and it always will be, because it's something people will always like to do. So, you know, it was a good topic. It was a generally universally appealing topic.
Yeah, and I think we went into it wanting to make it evergreen that way too, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. And it is. I mean, gosh, it's fun. Like, even now, it's been a while since I actually, you know, I've been working on some other stuff, and I was coming back for this interview and looking at it, and it got me excited again. Like, oh, I want to draw, and I want to look up all these other resources, and I want to look at other people's drawings. And I think that's the other thing too, is like, once you do it, this is what helps make it successful. Like, once you start doing it yourself and you're drawing, you want to share it. And you've seen that, like, right, with your readers. They want to share as part of the SketchNote Army, and they invited people to post their SketchNotes on the Flickr site. And you get so excited about what you've done and feel so creative that you want to show it to somebody. And everybody does that. Like, you just, and that's part of the, makes it so wonderful too, is it? So it contributes to sharing, this community where everybody wants to share. That's not very typical of most of the books that I do, but I think it did help to make people, you know, spread the word about the book, because they're sharing what they like to share, what they learned. They like to share their sketch notes and their drawings with other people. Mm-hmm. And then I guess other people excited to do it too. So
yeah, it's sort of it's contagious in some ways. And so I've sort of, While we've been talking about this, I've been trying to reach back and think of some good stories that I can share, because I haven't answered your question. So there's a teacher out in, I think he's in Utah, named Stuart. He's a high school teacher. And he wrote in and said to me, so I picked up the SketchNote handbook, I believe it was, and he said, I really love this idea, and I wondered how my high school students would react to it if I taught with this concept. So what he did is he did an experiment where he basically did his lesson, but he sketchnoted it, and he invited his students to go along. Like, he provided paper and pens, probably just copier paper and pens or something. Wasn't anything fancy. And he was teaching, I believe, science. So he went and did this class, and he introduced the sketchnoting stuff, and the students were like totally dialed in. Like, he was shocked. Like, he emailed and said, I can't believe, like, I offered the students to do this, and you know, some of the students were hesitant because they felt they couldn't draw or whatever. But once they got going, that they really got engaged. He felt like they were really absorbing the content that he was teaching and understanding it in a different way. And he got really excited and wrote in and was excited. And I think he actually bought the handbook, and I sent him the workbook review copy so that he could sort of expand on it and maybe apply some of the other ideas that were in that book. And then one other story that comes to mind is my friend David Sparks, who's, for some podcast listeners, he's kind of famous. He runs Mac Power Users podcast, and he's known as Mac Sparky. So he's like this lawyer who's really into Macs, but he also uses SketchNotes. And he admittedly says, I'm not a great artist. But what he does is he prepares his, like, if he does a brief in front of a judge, he gets a one sheet, like an 8.5 by 11 page. And I think he uses the whole thing, or maybe he splits it in half. But basically, he draws out his motions that he's going to present. And he comes, he said, he even gets, when he talked to me, he said he gets chuckles by the other attorneys, because he comes in with this one sheet of paper. But he uses icons to help him remember, like, silly things. And you can see this if you have the SketchNote workbook. I don't know what page it's in, but it's he's got a snapshot of a sample. He couldn't give me a real one, but he made one sort of like what he would use. And so the lawyers sort of scoff at him when he comes in, and he, like, puts this one paper down, and then he basically, you know, wipes the floor with him because he's so prepared. Like, it's so clear what he's going to do. And then he kind of smiles and he walks out with his sketchnote, right? He's ready to go. And he builds the sketchnote in a way that not only is it a presentation guide, but he leaves room on the sketch note for him to write notes. So when he walks out of the room, not only has he used it to present, but it actually captures the information that he needs to then move the motion to the next step. And then he just takes it back and goes to, you know, his Mac and starts building his case, however he normally does. So that was a really interesting application of the idea that I thought was really fascinating. We were able to get that in the workbook.
You know, and it crosses so many professions, right? It's so many, and it's so useful. Like, I think, wasn't there a doctor who used it to explain to her patients, you know, what was kind of happening to them? Or, you know, maybe I'm misremembering now.
No, you're right. That's Dr. Vardabedian. He's down in Texas, and he is a pediatrician, and he has a whiteboard in his office. He's sort of known as the drawing doctor. In fact, he's reached out and said he's working on some kind of book and was interested in maybe doing, he's thinking about doing the drawings himself and was asking for advice. But he basically sits in his office with the parents and the kids, and he'll sit there with a whiteboard and draw, you know, what's going on and then how we're going to deal with it. Like, he'll write, okay, here are the medications we're going to use, or here's the surgery we're going to do, and here's what it's going to do. And he draws the whole process out, and by sort of revealing it in this visual way, the parents understand it and the kids understand it, and they have a better, you know, it's not a mystery. I think the problem with a lot of times with medical procedures is, like, there's so much unknown. Like, that's mm-hmm. actually maybe the thing you're fearing more than anything else. Of course, there's just, you know, things going wrong, worrying about that. But if you sort of know what's going into it, and he's writing it out and putting it in a way that you can visually absorb it, rather than, you know, throwing you a stack of papers that you got to read through and it's all in doctor speak and all that kind of stuff. He found that this is really effective for not only the parents, but the kids to understand mm-hmm. what's going on. And I thought that was just a really cool idea.
Well, and I love that too. I think anyone can benefit from it, because I like the idea of taking any topic, especially ones that are really confusing or complex, and using images to make it more accessible to everybody, right? Like, I think that's what the wonderful thing about sketchnotes and how it's affecting or how people from so many different professions are using it to make their work more accessible to more people. Wouldn't that be great, you know, imagine if your tax forms were explained in, you know, or instead of a contract, people could use pictures. I don't know, everything can be made easier to understand with more images. And I love that doctors and lawyers and teachers are starting to think more visually like that because of sketchnoting, and they're feeling confident that they can do it themselves. I love what we've done. I'm taking partial credit, even though I didn't do that much, but I love what we've done and the impact it's had on people. And I hope it continues. It seems like it is. I was just reading reviews on Amazon and you know, people still posting, you know, for the handbook, which came out, gosh, so long ago. People are just getting it and loving it. And I love this one review. The title is, "I Can Now Draw Stick Figures." And he's really excited about it. So,
wow. Yeah, I think it's, you know, ultimately what I was setting out to do with these books, and it isn't immediately apparent, is I just feel like they're, you know, I found in my note-taking that I got stuck in this, I have to write everything down mode, and I wasn't really drawing much, and it just felt like a burden to me. And I felt like, gosh, there's got to be so many other people that have the same problem, and we can maybe break them out of that. And that initially was how it started, you know, and the whole doing it and experimenting and sort of sharing was sort of bound into the whole thing from the beginning. And then by the time we met, I'd been doing it for a couple of years and sort of had this sense of, you know, this is sort of freeing people. Because I was getting messages even at that time from people that were trying it and finding it really helpful for them to understand the ideas, even if they didn't share it, just to help them process through things. So then having the platform to build a book that sort of encapsulates it in a physical form and, you know, in a digital form that basically encourages people to have confidence. Ultimately, that's really what it is, right? It's have the confidence to try and do a little bit more than you've done in the past and feel good about the place where you are without feeling like, you know, you haven't fully arrived, but you've made steps forward. And that's a huge thing in any kind of change of life that's really tough to achieve. So if we can help, I kind of wonder too, like, if we've helped people make those little steps in their ability to draw on their confidence, like, how has that maybe impacted other things? Because from what I'm understanding, having confidence in one area can actually bleed over into other stuff too.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, okay, here's a story. My son would be so embarrassed, so I'm not going to name his name, but he was a late to learning to ride a bicycle, and he was always, he's a cautious kid. So he's like, God, he'd be so humiliated. I almost feel bad for sharing the story, but he just learned how to ride a bike and he's 10. He finally, you know, every summer we tried to get him to do it and he wouldn't do it. Every summer he would just, you know, come up with an excuse to do something else because he was afraid he'd fall off or lose control, or he just couldn't figure out how to do it. And he struggled every time. The couple of times he tried, he struggled and didn't like it. Well, he finally this spring learned how to ride a bicycle, and I could see his confidence. I could see it in him. I could see him change, and it affected other things. Right now, this season he had his best season of soccer. He plays soccer. He plays travel soccer, and it was his best season ever. He looked more confident on the field. He scored more goals than he ever had. Other parents were like, "Wow, what has happened to him? He just seems so he's so much better this year." And I swear to you, it is because he finally learned how to ride a bicycle, and that confidence, you know, is affecting other parts of his life. And I think that's the same with drawing, right? I think it's anything you do where you start to feel like anything that sparks this creative confidence and you feel good about yourself is going to make you feel good about yourself in general. It's going to make you feel it's anything that you do that makes you feel good is good for you. And well, okay, that's bad. That's probably not true. But like, you know, if you can get confident in drawing, I do think it can make you confident in other areas of your life, make you a happier person. Who, you know, and that's always good.
Yeah. I think it also, the thing I think of when I hear that story is, you know, we have little kids, and our son just learned how to be potty trained. Like now we'll be playing and dad, hold on, I got to go potty. Like, okay, you go do that. Like, you know, it's really exciting for us. And, you know, I can sort of see the confidence in him as well and how his life is changing a little bit at a time. Like you sort of have to capture those moments. But I think what it brought me back to is I've always thought of myself as a really late bloomer. Like, I didn't go to college in the normal way. I sort of went late and I went to this technical college and then I switched careers and ended up in this other place. And, you know, I was there, I was older than a lot of the people I worked with. Even now I'm working in a place where a lot of the people I'm working with are younger than me. But I've never allowed that to sort of stop me. Like I've always tried to have the mindset of a open young person and take new things and try new things. So I think maybe he's just a late bloomer. And we think about that, like comparing our own kids, like our daughter was, you know, she's in kindergarten reading like at a second grade level or something. She's just amazing. But every kid is a little bit different. Like, and you sort of have to appreciate each one where they are, because maybe, you know, him riding his bike was just like this alignment, like everything had to align up and then it works really well. And you try not to be discouraged that it's taking a little bit longer than somebody else, because your time is right because it's your time, right? So I think the same way with sketchnoting, like some people, maybe I've noticed there's some who come to it late in life, and that you could very easily say, oh, you know, I'm old now, I can't learn how to draw now. But the approach that we took somehow seems to help them get over this hump somehow. I'm not sure what the magic secret sauce was that we used. And I guess it doesn't always work for everybody, but I think a little bit of it is their mindset, but then being open to it.
I think part of it too is conquering your fear, right? Like my kid had this fear of riding his bike that quietly grew over the mm-hmm. years, and then became embarrassing because his other friends could do it and he couldn't. And then he conquered this fear, and there's an empowerment to that. And I think a lot of people have a creative fear, like they fear that they're not creative enough, or they can't draw, or they're not as creative as someone else. I mean, I think that's a true fear, even among very creative people or successful people. I think they have these fears too. And I think what was great about the book is that it was so simple. I mean, like some people might think maybe too simple, but it was so simple. It taught you very simple techniques to conquer this fear of drawing and start doing it. And I think that was the secret sauce, right? I think that was the success. And it showed, right? It used pictures. It showed. It was so simple. The techniques are very simple. Drawings are very simple. It felt very approachable. Anybody can do it. Then you very slowly draw your first little stick figure or your first, you know, you do letter, you try lettering for the first time, and you're conquering your fears. And that's very empowering.
Yep. I see that a lot in the, so I do workshops and talks, and part of, I try to make even the talks when I can, having activities where the people in the audience draw something. And I definitely see people very self-conscious, like they won't come up and share their work. And I just respect that. I know that, you know, there's things that maybe I would feel not confident to do, and I would appreciate if someone didn't force me to do it. But there are always people in those events that would love to come up. You know, maybe they're more outgoing or maybe they're more confident or whatever. They're just in the place where they can do it. And so I've just been really observing as I do all these workshops now to understand that for people to bear their creative skills in front of people can feel to them really revealing, and maybe their fear of embarrassment to show, well, my drawing skills are still like a third grade level, even though I'm this successful whatever, right? It's revealing this deficiency or this, you know, it's like you're like if your left arm was really shriveled, like it would be like taking your coat off and then you could see your arm was kind of shriveled. Like, I mean, that's sort of a metaphor, but this idea that you're revealing something about yourself that's not to your ideal, and it's good for me to sort of recognize that not everybody's ready and they're at different places, and to let them sort of be where they're at and just accept that they do as much as they can and then make the next step.
Well, you know, so readers don't know, but we worked together for a long time. We worked did a whole book, two books, before I actually met you in person.
Yep.
And the first time I met you in person was when you came to Michigan and you did a workshop for the Ross School of Business. When I live in Ann Arbor and I work from home in Ann Arbor. And so I got to meet you there for the first time and I got to sit in on your workshop, and it was so fun to watch. You were doing it for, I believe, as business students who you wouldn't think would be as creative. It's not like you're at an art school or, you know, the School of Design, or, you know, you're giving a workshop for the business students. And I was so amazed by how creative and good their sketch notes were. And they were dying to show them off. Like, they, when you gave them a chance to like show their work, they were all like their hands up, dying to jump up and come to the front of the room and show their ideas. And they were all so good. I was really impressed by the quality of their drawings, like for business people. So whatever, the workshops were really empowering for these people, and maybe they're young and they're students, but I was really impressed.
Well, I've just recently taught a couple of things at Marquette University, which is right here in Milwaukee. And just being young and a student doesn't guarantee that you're willing to share, or that you're, there are definitely students who are afraid to come up, and I'm not worried about that at all, because, you know, I know when they're ready, then they can do the next step. But it is fun to see, like you mentioned, you wouldn't think that business students would be that interested in it. But I think also, so there's this whole design thinking thing that I know you're really interested in, I'm really interested in. It's going on inside business right now, which I think is really tied to sketchnoting in a lot of ways, that sketchnoting can be a really good foundation for expression within a design thinking activity inside a company or whatever. So I think the Ross School students really did have a mindset for design because of that movement. And I thought maybe they had some teaching from design thinking people coming through in that speaker series. And, you know, as a little tidbit, they're trying to build like an innovation center. They've got some innovation centers at Marquette. So they're really excited, because I went over and taught some creative students. They're taking like marketing, and we did like the 1 hour sketchnote mini workshop. And then there were some entrepreneurial center people that were there, and they had me come and speak. And now we're planning a workshop for the staff so they can start learning this concept and start teaching it. So it's really fun to sort of have this impact and see sketchnoting be really kind of a visual language that people can use when they get in these situations, when you're on a whiteboard and you've got to explain your thinking. If you're not confident, you're going to avoid that. But the reality is, if you go to the board and you start drawing, you own the room, right? You're the person at the front and center, and you have an opportunity to collaborate and show, you know, your thinking. So I think,
well, yeah, it's essential to design thinking. I mean, that's part of the ideation stage, is you're kind of drawing out your ideas and you're sharing them, and even the prototyping stage, you're making things. So I think I do think sketchnoting is probably really useful to any field, but also, I mean, especially to the design thinking movement that's now being taught in so many business schools. And even like medical schools, I think Mayo Clinic is doing a lot with the innovation, and they've had a lot of design thinking instructors down there to try to like encourage innovation in the medical industry. Oh, maybe you can do a workshop down there, Mike. Here's something too. Like, a lot of people don't realize that their favorite authors are not full-time authors. Like, they don't spend all day writing books. They actually have other jobs, and the book making happens late at night and on the weekends, and, you know, in the spare moments in between all the other stuff you do. So what I was excited to see for you was, after the book came out, like how it really took off professionally for you. Like, you got, you know, people calling you to do workshops and seminars, and it became a bigger part of your professional life, which I was excited to see. But now tell people like the workshops you have coming up, because I'm kind of excited about it.
Yeah. Well, right now, next week, I work as a user experience designer inside Northwestern Mutual, which is an insurance company. And we're doing really fun stuff. I'm actually applying sketchnoting right in the teams I'm on whiteboards mainly. But I've been invited to come to another group and teach sketchnoting to their staff. So they manage teaching sessions, and they wanted this ability to be more visual and to use a more visual approach to things. So I'll be doing that next week. So that's private. And then looks like probably in August, I'll be doing a visit to Colorado Springs, another private one. The private ones right now are just the ones that are working out, and I've done some public ones. So I'm thinking about maybe doing a public one someplace. I just don't know where it is. And then probably Marquette University later in the summer, and then Drexel University in October, which I think is actually a public one, or some parts of it are public. I still have to finalize the details for that. So that's sort of what I'm looking at right now, and there's a few other ones that are sort of bouncing around that may happen. So I know that after the first book came out, I think I traveled like once every month for the year after it launched. So, I mean, I definitely put the miles on to do that, but it's kind of fun for me to do. And it's definitely opened up doors, having the books as sort of a reference for people to, you know, see what I'm thinking, and then I can come in and share in more detail and then tailor it to their needs, because, you know, we're sort of aiming for this broad audience, and we can sort of talk, generally speaking, how things can be used, and you have to apply it. I think the reason why companies bring me in is because they like the concepts, they want to learn the basics, and then they say, how can we adapt this to our situation so we can make, how can we communicate, say, our fiscal year goals, one client had me do. And we just sat at a flip chart, and they told me what their PowerPoint was, and I converted it into drawings and then cleaned up the drawings for them, and they used it in all their presentation work inside the company. So, I mean, it's stuff like nobody outside the company would ever see it, but it's super valuable to those people who need it to sort of make things look different for them. Another one was last year I went out to New York City for an ad agency, and they wanted to be more visual, and they wanted to think through in their brainstorming sessions. They sort of often run out of ideas for what to use for icons. So we did teaching for the first half, and the second half I just sat down with the heads of these departments and said, okay, what's the kind of stuff that you typically present to clients, and what things are you missing? So let's work through that. So they made a big list of all the things they wanted to have icons for and ways to think about presenting. And we went on this big whiteboard and drew all the stuff out, and they took pictures, and they're starting to use those techniques in their pitches. So it's kind of fun to start with the generic idea and then adapt it to the needs of the people that you're presenting to. I quite enjoy it.
I think that is the thing that is probably the most difficult to get across in the book, because you want it to be for a general audience, right? But this is where I was always pushing you for more drawing techniques, and it was completely selfish on my part, because I am I am not a good artist. I am not an illustrator. And I remember I was trying to start my, you got me all psyched up and I was going to start my own sketchnote diary. And I kept a journal for a while and I was trying to draw every night in it. And it was fun because my kid loved to then look at it and make fun of my horrible drawings. But, you know, I was trying to draw a car and I couldn't draw tires. I'm like, I know what tires look like. I know I see tires every day, but and they're just circles. So why can't I? Why does it look like a donut every time I try? But so like I especially liked this very specific drawing technique. So I liked to, you know, to show me exactly how to very simply draw something that I would find hard to draw. And the ones that were the most complicated, and this is where I fall and fail every time I try to do sketching. It's like the hard concepts, the conceptual stuff. Like how do you take that and make that into drawings? Like that, it's a continual struggle for me, you know, when I'm learning about some very complicated or listening to a complicated speech or, you know, lecture and it's very, you know, it's not talking about houses and stick people and cars, which is, you know, like the simple things I do know how to draw. Like I think there's definitely a need to learn more. I would like more instruction on, you know, how to draw more things, like how to get these complex ideas and translate them into drawings. So I'm ready for more from you, Mike. I need more.
Well, and you do remember that we also we did the video podcast, I think 10 episodes of that. We did do some of that where we had suggestions from people that came in for more complex concepts. Mm-hmm. And then I would just sort of, you know, before the cameras rolled, I'd figure out, okay, how could I show that? And then I would teach it on the video. So I've actually thought about resurrecting that video podcast several times and doing the same kind of thing. We're just teaching basic drawing skills. And I may even be able to use my iPad Pro because there's an app that will actually record what you draw and then just turn it into a video. So you wouldn't really even need a camera. So that's been bouncing around in my head. I think there's an interesting guy who we had on the podcast several episodes ago, Rob DeMio, who is a physicist and was really interested in sketchnoting scientific talks. And you can look in the show notes for that if you haven't heard it yet.
Yeah.
But basically, he approached it sort of the way I taught it in the book, where he would sort of do it live. And he found that it was really tough with these scientific talks because these presenters would come in and they'd have really technical language and they'd assume you knew things and it was super high detail. And he was having a hard time struggling keeping up with this stuff because it was not it was not his specialty, right? He wanted to learn and push himself. So what he realized later was maybe the solution isn't just to come in and sort of wing it in the moment. Like you can do that with a TED talk because they're talking in generalities, but in scientific talks, they get super specific. So what he actually did is he would sit and prepare if he would line up and know when these people came that he wanted to hear. He would actually read up their papers and he would start thinking about, he would build icons for the concepts they're talking about ahead of it. So he had sort of a cheat sheet when he got to the sketchnote phase and he could just pull those icons out and be ready for them. So he sort of did all this legwork ahead of it so that when he got in the moment, then he could sort of relax and, you know, put in the parts that he thought and then he would even allow himself sort of after time, because he uses an iPad, he could move things around and delete things or tune things up. Or if he needed to look at some documentation and find a specific, like a formula or something, like you can't get it wrong, or, you know, he might blow things up, right? So he would make sure that all the very specific technical things were captured in an accurate way. So, I mean, he sort of took the idea and then just adapted it to his needs. So that's an interesting use of approach that I couldn't have imagined in only, you know, in his case, because he needed it. He actually built his own process for doing it, which is really cool. And I think the most satisfying thing about sort of writing a book and leading sort of a movement is seeing people taking it on their own and doing their own things without me necessarily having to start anything or be involved. It just sort of organically happens. That's really exciting, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely taking off. People are doing, and that's fun to see too. I was just doing a Google search before our talk to see, like, just to see what people are doing online, and a lot of people are doing it, and in using the sketchnoting term, which you coined. So, I mean, I know, I can see it's a direct result of what we've done, because, you know, that term wasn't even a term before we started, before you started doing it. So, and now it's just, it's everywhere, which is great.
Yeah, it's fun to see and fun to have had an influence in that way. Maybe the way I was thinking we could wrap up is talking a little about the book that never happened. I don't think I've talked in length about the 30-day sketchnoting challenge book that we brainstormed together. I came back to you and said, okay, it's been a couple of years. You know, I've forgotten how tough it is to write a book. Let's write another book.
And that's usually when people came back to me for their next book. They'd forgotten. It's like, you know, you forgot the pain of labor. Yeah. Well, I can do that again.
I mean, I sort of remembered it, but, you know, that was romanticized or whatever. But so we approached this idea, and we both thought it was kind of interesting. It was the idea that you would take 30 days and you would build these activities. And we never really got super deep into it, but this idea that you'd have a regular practice thing you do every day and then build on it over time. And then by the end of 30 days, we would be talking about that confidence that we talked about before. You would build this confidence over time. And it's interesting. I still think the idea is a really good idea, and I'm not really sure how it might come out, if it would be another book or if it would be something else. But unfortunately, things just didn't work out. There was a change at Peach Pit, and a lot of people were let go, and the book deal was canceled. And so that's just the way it worked out, but I was still pretty excited. I think you were excited about it too, and some of the things we could have done with that book.
Yep, it made me sad. I'm no longer with Peach Pit. I don't know if that's clear from the podcast. I was laid off in February along with a lot of people from Pearson. And it was really sad to see some of these projects that I was so excited to work on then not come to pass. But you know, I know that there is a future for it. There's just, you have to, I do think you're going to do something next. I don't know what that will be, whether it'll be a course or a book or a video, but it will be great. And I think there's still a need for it. I think people will always want to learn better, you know, learn more about how to draw, about how to incorporate it into their daily life, into their specific work, or, you know, their routines, and you know, it's continual. It's a fun thing to learn and do, so that people will always want to learn more about how to do it, you know.
Yeah, so. I agree. I think I feel there's something more in me. I don't know what it is. Sometimes I'll sit and think, okay, I've already produced two books and they're doing well. Like, what else do people really want to hear more from me? And that's usually when I think that, then I get some email like, oh, I'm so sad that the 30-day book didn't go. You should do something. So it's kind of interesting.
I'll try to stop emailing you, Mike. Those emails are always from me. Mike, I'm so sad that the 30-day book didn't work out. What can we do next?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, just when Mike thinks he can't do another book, I email him and say, we should do something.
Yeah. So we'll see where it goes. I think I'm really excited. I mentioned before that I'm working inside this company and using sort of all these sketchnoting techniques that I developed in the context of like a big corporation, and finding it really refreshing for people. Like, they've not seen this before and they really dig it. And I'm starting to think along the lines of, it'd be really interesting to do a book, maybe a little more conceptual, to pull in some of the research that's come out recently that sort of verifies that visual thinking is actually really valuable and a good way to communicate. If there's ways to pull in that research and maybe write it from the perspective of building the confidence, the visual confidence of people inside companies to do sort of these design thinking engagements or something. So that's sort of what's bouncing in my head right now. I don't know where it's going to go. I made a decision after the book got canceled, just take the summer off and let it percolate. I think sometimes the best ideas come then. And then maybe when the fall comes around, start thinking about, okay, where could this go? So that's sort of where it's headed right now, at least in my head, which is still just an idea floating around in there.
Well, listeners, what do you listeners want to know? What do you think Mike should do next?
Yeah, that would be great. Drop me an email or hit me up on Twitter or whatever. And maybe I need to do like a questionnaire or something like that and hear what people want. Maybe go from that direction. So
Well, yeah, too. Like there's so many things you could do. Like you could do this is always my favorite part of talking to Mike. Like, what could we do next? You know, it's like you could do sketchnoting for lawyers or sketchnoting for UX designers. Because that too I always thought would be kind of a fun way to go. Because, you know, like you said, like you can get so specific to a field and, you know, and show really specific sketchnoting techniques for the type of work that they do. That would be kind of fun. And then I figure if typography for lawyers could be a huge success, you know, why not sketchnoting for lawyers? But, you know.
Maybe I can do a coloring book.
why not? Everybody else is.
I think that train has already left the station.
No. Oh, no, it has not. Have you been to Barnes & Noble? Oh, my good God.
No,
you got to agree, though. Oh, I do wonder what the next big thing is. Like, what is the next childhood activity going to be that overtakes adults? You know, is it? Because if there was, you know, if dodgeball became like a huge grown-up thing, and then coloring books. Like, what's the next?
No idea. That'll be interesting to see what happens. Well, why don't you tell us, Nikki, where we can find you? Because I think there's people that are going to want to sort of chat with you and see what's going on with Nikki. What are good places to reach out to you?
Well, I'm supposed to be making my own website, which I've been supposed to be making for a while now. I'm trying to teach myself WordPress because I've always wanted to do it, and I know I need to learn it, and I don't think it's that hard. So I have a URL. It's scribwell.com, but I have not yet made my website. So I'm working on that. And in the meantime, you can reach me at scribwell@gmail.com if you want to drop me a line. That's my soon-to-be official email address when I get my website up and going. So,
How about Twitter? Can we reach out to you on Twitter?
Oh, yeah. I'm at NikkiMC.
Excellent.
You find me on Twitter there. And
That does the trick. And, you know, we'll put links to all Nikki's stuff in the show notes so you can go there and see that site that she's promised. And now she's on the record.
Oh, my gosh. Now I'm on it right now. I have to do it.
The pressure is on now.
It's so on.
And, you know, Nikki is a professional editor. So if you're in the position where, like, I have to write a book and I need someone for guidance, Nikki is the person that you need to reach out to. She can do copy editing as well as thinking strategy. She knows the book business. So if you're thinking about doing a book, you know, you can reach out to her, and she's very helpful and nice. So definitely do that. I think it's definitely worth your time to reach out to Nikki.
Thanks, Mike. One of my favorites. I can help. I do miss helping people make books. That was always the fun part of, like, seeing people have this idea and then making it real and you know, watching their ideas come together. I do miss doing it. So if you have an idea, let me know. I'm happy to help.
Definitely reach out. She knows what she's doing. So thank you, Nikki, for coming on the show. And we appreciate you making time for us. And thanks for sharing.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for talking to me today. It was fun.
You're so welcome. And so, everybody, we're going to call that the end of the show. And we'll see you on the next Sketchnote Army podcast. Mm-hmm.